Accession number 21289, wheel 3.
As a whole, to rail 3.
Having got back to England, the regiment was formed into squadron and placed on aerodromes throughout the south of the country. I, with E Squadron, were finished up on an aerodrome called Downampney, which was halfway between Cheltenham. Not Cheltenham, Cirencester and Swindon, and very near Cricklade. And that's where we stayed virtually until the war finished. The next job they gave us to do, of course, was D-Day. And, D-Day. We spent the rest of the time training one way or another, and one of the things we had to learn to do with this training was to fly in the air with the rest of the gliders. Oh dear, excuse me.
In formation, you mean?
Yeah, we had to write. So we did that, and we had to learn to land in formation. So we would take off, and we would fly and meet the gliders from other aerodromes. Then we would fly together, possibly 40 or 50 all together. Then we would come back to our own aerodromes, and the squadron would learn to land as a squadron. That is not just one at a time on an aerodrome, but there are four or five or even up to 10 landing together. And we had a squadron major who loved to ask us to land so that we were standing to attention, wingtip to wingtip. And we did stupid things like that, but it was good training. One other method of training he gave us was to get a circle, possibly 6 foot diameter or more, placed on the runway, and our job then was to land so that our nose wheel finished up on the centre of this circle. This is all good stuff because it gave us taught us the accuracy that was required to put gliders where they were most use after they'd landed in a foreign country. Remembering that we did not have engines, so we couldn't reduce our speed to any great extent, except that the only way we could reduce our speed was with the use of flaps. By the way, a Horsa glider had flaps that were 18 inches in depth. And once they were fully down, we could put a glider into a steep decline of about 85 degrees. So we could get down very quickly. So the next operation we trained to do was... It was D-Day, wasn't it?
Yes.
Yeah, it was D-Day. And that was that wasn't a very difficult D-Day. We took off. We landed to Sword Beach, I think it was. We stayed there for two or three days. We didn't do any fighting. We just backed up the paratroops who were in front of us. All the hard work had been done by those gliders that landed and took Pegasus Bridge. I wasn't one of those, but they did a marvellous job, those lads. They were trained especially for that job.
Who or what did you take across to Normandy? Did you take troops or equipment?
You know, I forget. Oh, yes, artillery again.
Artillery.
No, it wasn't artillery. It was infantry. I was just trying to remember. RURs, Royal Ulster Rifles. Mm. That's who I took to them.
Did you have a smooth landing?
Landing there was by the Germans. They tried to make it difficult because they stuck them great posts up in the fields, which was quite. We were quite happy about that because all we did was land between them, and our wings hitting the posts either side helped us to stop quickly, which we did. We had no opposition on the ground where we landed, but we formed up as a squadron again, and then with the rest of the glider pilots, and we stood as reserves. We got ourselves into trenches and we stayed as reserves for 2 or 3 days. We were then relieved by Lord Lovett and his men, and we came back to, marched back to the beach and were then taken back to England after three, I think it was 3 days. And go on.
Do you remember who your co-pilot was?
You know, I can't.
Why was it necessary to have two pilots?
You need a first pilot and a second pilot.
Why was that? Why didn't you just have
Well, if one got shot, the other one can fly. Well, you needed two pilots on those. I mean, the same way as a bomber had two pilots, then we had to. And plus the fact that the second pilot has certain things to do with the controls, like, which I won't go into detail. We needed two pilots. There was no doubt about that.
And did you also go in a hawser to Normandy?
Oh, no, yes, Normandy was hawsers. From then on, we flew hawsers.
So you've been in a whacker to...
Yeah, unfortunately, I never flew one of those things again.
Did you not like them?
I didn't like them at all, not one bit.
What was the problem with them?
I just didn't like them. I think it was... perhaps it was being British, I don't know. You can do more with a hawser. You can do more real flying with a hawser than you could do with a Wacko. Let's put it that way, shall we? For instance, you could do stall turns in a hawser. You can, if you did that in a Wacko, it might something might happen. Mind you, we weren't supposed to do stall turns. That was against the rules. You know what a stall turn is, do you?
You mean where you go slowly?
No. Well, you come down fast. And you pull the stick back, and then you did which made the glider stall. And then you could turn it round whilst you were stuck up in the air and go back the way you came. That's what they call a stall turn.
So why was it banned?
You were not supposed to do any acrobats whatsoever in gliders. That was a rule. I only did it once, by the way. Only did it once.
So I think you were saying you came back to England after. Well,
we came back then, of course. But back what's the name of the place I was at? Down Abney. We came back to Down Abney, the next operation of. The next operation was the Arnhem, but before we went to Arnhem, of course, the troops that we'd landed at in France for D-Day had to get further, had to take Caen and odd places like that, and so did the Americans who landed on the south coast of the Med. They were coming up and meeting our lads, met our lads and their own lads off in France and went up through Paris and places like that. But whilst they were doing that, It was thought for 16 times that they might want the help of airborne forces. So during the period of time between taking off for from getting back to from France to taking off for Arnhem, we were briefed for 16 operations. And that was more hard work than actually doing an operation, because in the first place, for every operation, you were confined to camp for 1 to 2 weeks. And during that period of time, you had to train for what they were asking you to do. And every one of those operations was cancelled. Some of them was airplanes, well, gliders were actually filled with men and ready to take off. Some were gliders had taken off, but they were still cancelled because after they'd taken Cannes and everything, the American forces and our own forces moved so quickly from that from there to north of Paris that they got back. They'd gone past our landing area, so that went on, of course, until we started training for Arnhem, which was March.
Not September.
Yes, yes. I've stepped another operation. That was, which of course was September, and for Arnhem. So, what do you want me to do now?
If you could take me through Arnhem, please. Was it with the same squadron?
Oh, yes, yes, yes. Well, the British forces, having got themselves into such a position that Montgomery said, the next thing I want to do is to take Arnhem. He says, because if I take Arnhem, we can go round over the Rhine and down and capture everybody. So we were ordered to take the bridge at Arnhem. That's, when I say we, I mean the airborne forces. We, the glider pilots, were given the job of taking taking the airborne army to Arnhem. The object to take the bridge at Arnhem was to take the bridges before Arnhem, which was at Grave, Nijmegen, and then the Arnhem Bridge. The Americans were asked to take the Grave and the Nijmegen Bridge, whilst we, the British Airborne Forces, were asked to cross the river at Arnhem, or adjacent Arnhem, and make sure that that bridge was taken. Actually, what did happen was that to take the airborne forces to Arnhem itself, they decided that we couldn't land our gliders adjacent to the bridge at Arnhem, and the nearest place was in the area of a place called Oosterbeek, which was 8 miles from the bridge itself. So we landed in three phases. I was on the first phase, which was, I think, the 17th of March or thereabouts. Was it 17th of March or thereabouts? And we had we landed quite well. There was no problem. We landed on target. We were able to get into form together as a squadron, march into Oosterbeek.
Who had you taken this time, do you remember?
I took Dados, and Dados is the Deputy Assistant Director of Ordnance Services, and his job, of course, that was a divisional officer. His job was to ensure that all the area, the ordnance corps, were able to distribute the requirements, like vehicles, petrol, etc. That was his job. Anyway, he was Dados himself was a full colonel, and one of the things he did was I think he was a full colonel, perhaps he was a lieutenant colonel. He was quite pleased with the fact that we dropped him exactly where he thought he'd been told he would be dropped, and to thank me, he gave me two pistols and with holsters and ammunition. He said, his words were, make good use of those, please.
Was it just him in the glider?
Oh, no, his staff. There was Dados. When I say Dados, it was the man himself plus his staff, yeah. Well, they went off and joined the rest of the staff wherever where they'd been assigned to go. What we did, we got together with a squadron, marched into Oosterbeek, took up a position to oppose any German attacks very near a railway bridge.
Had you got any reception from the civilians?
Oh, yes. The poor people, were pleased as punch to see us. They clapped their hands as we marched through the village, etc., etc. But later on, they were not so pleased. We went to we got to this bridge, this railway bridge, we were positioned in trenches on a hill overlooking the bridge. And whilst we were there, after the second day, I think it might have been, or even after the first day, we were attacked by German forces from below and German aeroplanes who had found us and strafed us and bombed us to the extent that we had to retire from there. The place was too open, there weren't enough trees about to hide under, shall we say. And we finished up then moving backwards and moving to two or three places during the day, and so we came back to the north of Oosterbeek, where we, as a squadron, were placed to defend on the edge of a wood overlooking a field on the other side of this were the German forces. And there we stayed for quite a while, exchanging fire. I was then asked to take over the rank of Squadron Sergeant Major because our Squadron Sergeant Major had been killed whilst landing. And I was taken back into the HQ of the squadron, and from there, for the next two or three days, I made sure that our lads had ammunition, etc., etc., what a sergeant major does. But after a while, when things, after a few days, we were becoming, the Germans were getting nearer and nearer, etc., and I finished up in the front line of the wood that was adjacent to us. And we were continuously attacked by the Germans. I then, previous to that, had exchanged my rifle for a Bren gun, which I used quite effectively, having run out of ammunition for revolvers, because that's how close the Germans were coming. And that continued.
What were the Germans attacking you with? Just infantry?
Their favourite weapon was a mortar which fired six or eight shells at a time. And then they were attacking us with normal rifles and I think, what's the name of that German gun, Schmeisser or something like that?
Machine gun.
Machine gun, yeah. They were those, the sort of tactics that we got up to were, they would suddenly appear where we were in a trench, and then there was an open space and then a wood. And they would suddenly appear dashing out of this wood, and then we'd make sure they got back in again. I was lucky there at one time, because one German soldier kept coming. He didn't get shot down, and one of his shots went through the head of the soldier standing beside me. I didn't know his name. I didn't know his regiment, actually, but because we were all mixed up then, one way or another. But I killed him. So that went on and on, and for the last 2 days, I think it was, I finished up in a house with two or three other lads. The house was part of the front line, because as you looked out of the windows of the house, you could see the Germans on the other side of the street. And the same, they'd shoot at us now and again, and we'd shoot back at them. That's how the war was going at that time. After 10 days, I think it was 10 days, 10, 9, 10, 11, around there, HQ decided that we had to retreat across the river. And during that period of 10 days, obviously, the ground forces, the second Montgomery's army, had managed to get to the other side of the river, and the there's the Canadians there as well. They were engineers who managed to get boats across the river to us, and also a unit. I forget the name of it now, but it was a unit from the south of England, like the Devons or something of that nature. I think I've got that name down there, whatever it was. They'd opened a space for us. So we were then told to get ourselves back down to the river, and the method of doing it was that certain glider pilots who'd been in headquarters were used as guides, and I talk about the five or six chaps who were with me in this house. Our job then was to get from the house to the trail that was going to take us down to the river. And what we did, we had tails on our piece of clothing that we used, and was to hold each other's tail and follow. And so we did that, and we were taken down to the river. I do apologise for not remembering all the names of army things, because I'm getting old and I'm forgetting things. You don't mind that, do you?
No, no.
Eventually got to the river, got on a little boat that was driven by paddles by the Canadian REs, and we paddled across the river. Except when we got halfway across, the mortar bombs that the Germans were dropping all over the place upset the boat a bit, and the lads lost the pedals. Anyway, most of us had rifles, so we paddled across with our rifles and got to the other side of the river, and came via a large barn where they gave us drinks and fed us. And we finished up in Nijmegen.
Were you under fire as you crossed the river?
Oh, yes. They were. It was mortar fire. We weren't. I don't remember rifle fire. Certainly, some of them were under rifle fire. Those who were nearer where the Germans were. But it was certainly mortar fire all the time when we were crossing. It didn't do it was quite dangerous for some of the lads. But we were lucky again.
What condition were you in by the time you got across the Rhine?
I was wet, cold and hungry. It's as simple as that, really.
But unwounded?
No, I wasn't wounded at all. Well, yes, that was... that's it.
In your thumb?
I'd hurt my thumb. That's why it's that shape. And it got poisonous. That's all.
That's on your right hand.
Yeah, I forgot how that happened. It just happened. It was one of those things that just happened. Could have been a bit of shrapnel that hit it or something like that. But that's all. I mean, as far as I was concerned, it was nothing. That's all I had. I was quite lucky there. So we get back to Nijmegen. We stay in Nijmegen for a while, enjoy ourselves. Then we went back via Brussels by air, back to Downampney again. Getting ready for the next operation, which...
Rhine Crossing?
It was the Rhine Crossing, yeah. Mm. Yeah, that was horrible.
Can you take me through that one, please?
Let's see. March 17th, wasn't it? Right.
It was March 1945.
So between September 44 and March 45, we started training for the Rhine Crossing itself. And the Rhine Crossing, for the Rhine Crossing, they made quite sure that the mistakes made for Arnhem didn't happen again. And one of those mistakes were, we landed too far away from the bridge, 8 miles. So by the time everybody had landed and tried to fight through 8 miles of Germans, we didn't get the bridge, as you know. So for the Rhine crossing, they made quite sure that, one, there was no question of us landing too far away from the enemy. Our targets were actually just behind the Germans, who were on the other side of the Rhine from the lads at the moment. And the other one was that for the Arnhem things, they had 3 phases of landing. 3 days. Landings were operating on the first day, second day, and third day, so that the whole units were not able to get together immediately. So for the Rhine crossing, they got every glider they could in the country. They got every pilot that was left in the country, and they got into and to make up the losses that we'd had at Arnhem and other places, they recruited RAF pilots who had been trained but were not required because the RAF hadn't lost as many pilots as they thought they were going to do. So these poor lads were seconded to us in the glider pilot regiment. And just to go by the side again, we had to train them to be soldiers, which wasn't fair on the glider, on the RAF lads. In fact, we lost 55 of the poor lads on the Rhine crossing. So the whole idea was to land everybody at one time in a place on top of or as near the enemy as we could possibly could, and it came off.
What was your flight across like on that occasion?
No problems at all. On all the flights, let me answer that question by saying that on all the flights that we did on our way to our targets, we were always looked after by the RAF. There was always fighters around making sure that we didn't get shot down by the Germans. And the same thing happened on this one. The only problem we had was not from the air, but from the ground. Because when we got near our target, within all we could see in front of us was a pall of smoke. And what the British lads had done to they'd lit smoke fires all the way along the river on the